happens when a community is experiencing a sacrificial crisis. And part of what that means is that the threat, violence, is supposed to be kept outside a community. And the differences are supposed to be stark, that the people that are within the community are can be trusted and are good, and the bad guys are out there with all their violence. And so, but when the enemy is within and can't be separated out, you have what's called a sacrificial crisis.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and I am going to be joined very soon by my friend and colleague here at the Raven Foundation, Suzanne Ross, and we are going to be talking about a couple of articles on the New York Times about Facebook and how it might fuel a sense or a thirst for revenge among people. So that's going to be our discussion for today. As we get Suzanne up and running on here, I just want to let you know that on Monday, this coming Monday, my colleague at Raven, Lindsay Paris Lopez, and I will be continuing our discussion on Tony Bartlett's book, Seven Stories. So we're going to be in our fifth of seven conversations. So you can watch us there on any meeting. I'm going to bring in Suzanne
now. So here we go. There she is. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Adam.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good. We are having this amazing weather here in Portland, Oregon. So it's 82 degrees outside, and it's awesome. So I'm digging it.
I'm a little jealous.
Well, the rain is coming tomorrow, so good standard weather. So we get it for about a couple of days, and then the rain comes back. But yeah, so that's the Portland weather. Chicago is not so good.
Chicago's a little still chilly.
Yeah, that happens.
Little on the chilly side, but you know, we keep our fingers crossed. We're very hopeful here in Chicago.
Yes, it's good to have hope.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, Suzanne, we are here live on Facebook. How about that? And people can join us live on Facebook to talk about Facebook and whether Facebook is a good thing or a bad thing. Facebook has been in the news a lot lately. But before we get into our conversation, I just want to let people know that you can make comments in the comment section there below the video, and I will try to bring them in to our conversation. So Facebook, Suzanne, has been in the news quite a bit recently, and maybe Facebook is facing its biggest PR problems that it's ever had.
Right. Yeah, no, it certainly has been getting a lot of negative publicity just on privacy issues with that Cambridge Analytica somehow getting all this personal data. But then recently we saw this article in the paper about tracking places in which, you know, the rumors on Facebook actually led to real events of violence and lynchings. And it's very interesting to raise the question of, you know, how much responsibility does Facebook have in these situations? There's plenty of blame to go around, I think, in these things. But yeah, I mean, there was that interesting article about this particular incident in Sri Lanka, it's very interesting that it fell along sort of religious lines, because Sri Lanka is a Buddhist majority country, and there are these rumors that the Muslim minority is trying to wipe out the Buddhist majority, and that they have these plans to sterilize, secretly, implant sterilization drugs in food and so forth. And so, you know, to us, the rumors sound a little wild and unbelievable. Yet in our country, we have similar concerns about the Muslim minority threatening the Christian majority, right, and having all these plots. So I found that parallel very interesting, because it points to, you know, what we've been talking about in the Violence and Sacred book discussions, is what happens when a community is experiencing a sacrificial crisis. And part of what that means is that the threat, violence, is supposed to be kept outside a community. And the differences are supposed to be stark, that the people that are within the community are, can be trusted and are good, and the bad guys are out there with all their violence. And so, but when the enemy is within and can't be separated out, you have what's called a sacrificial crisis. So, you know, we have Muslims in our country, and we're trying to get them out. We're trying to keep them out and get them out because they're perceived as the threat. And the same thing was happening in Sri Lanka, where these rumors took on this aspect of being, of feeling like they were true. And so there was an outbreak of violence against the Muslims.
Yeah, and Facebook was a tool that many of these Buddhists were using in order to fuel this anxiety, this hatred, this violence against these minority Muslims in their midst. So they would some of them would create memes that were talking about how Muslims were the ones who were trying to sterilize all the Buddhists, and it was in their food. And then they went and found a chef who was there was this large chunk of flour within somebody's food, and they said, "Oh, that's the medicine that's going to sterilize us." And they speak different languages, and so the chef was like, yeah, that's flour. And all they heard was, yeah. And then they go after him, and they beat him and destroy his place, his restaurant. So, and what is interestingly, Suzanne, as Facebook is facing this major PR scandal or problems, they're at the very same time more profitable than ever.
It's just wild, because they are a global phenomenon right now, and they are reaching out into these lesser developed countries, and in places that where English is not the main language, and Facebook is facing this very difficult task, I think, of monitoring this explosion in use in language groups that they are not equipped to monitor. And even when they are getting alerted to dangerous posts and language, their response time is dangerously slow.
Well, and their response time is dangerously slow. And they say that really nasty language that does clearly incite violence doesn't go against their policy.
Right.
So, yeah. It's this, you know, I'm at the point where I'm like, when do we drop this Facebook thing? Because this is like it is, I don't want to scapegoat Facebook for this, because we users are also responsible for this, right? I mean, Facebook knows that the biggest way to keep us on Facebook is to promote posts that are hostile, that are negative, that that kind of go to our most base nature of anger and resentment. And this is what gets us most passionate. And that's the stuff that we share. And that's what keeps us on Facebook for their advertising, right? So at what point do we either have to hold Facebook to account for these things? Or at what point do we just leave Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is a human problem. I mean, mm-hmm. Facebook is very clever. I mean, one of the founders of Facebook was Peter Thiel, who is a well-known mimetic theory guy and a former student of René Girard. And Facebook understands how human community forms around negative identities and being against and inciting hatred. And these things are age-old human problems. And Facebook, hey, it's a human platform. And up to this point, they have denied any responsibility for what happens on their platform, which I think they're realizing is a mistake. They have to take responsibility for it. But, you know, their business model is such that, you know, they're going to have to figure out a way to make money without inciting us to our lowest selves. Mm-hmm. And so part of, as you're saying, we need to take responsibility for that and not get caught up in this rumor mongering, which, you know, it happens wherever Facebook is because it happens wherever people are. And so, I mean, rumors spread. Rumors spread fast. And, you know, I'm just noting the coincidence that we had planned this conversation for today. And it's the day that the lynching memorial is opening in Montgomery, Alabama. The first really public acknowledgement of the way rumors against Black men just spread and were believed because the threat, you know, is seen, you know, as within the community, and you can't wait for the legal system to respond, for the police to respond. You have to act. And this was the justification for this horror of lynching. And it, you know, it continues to be the horror of violence against Black people in this country. And so, yeah, rumors feel true because they feed on your fear. And so we need to begin to recognize when we're being tricked into thinking something is true. Mm-hmm. Because just because everyone's sharing it doesn't make it true, you know.
And yeah, I think that's important to talk about. What are the signs when you're being tricked into believing rumors that are just rumors? Like this is we have a great page on our Raven Foundation website, the Raven Review, of how to know if you're getting caught up in scapegoating.
Right. And
there are a couple of different ways. I think one of them is when hate feels really good. Like, hate can give us a sense of belonging to a certain group. And I think this is one of the things that Girard in mimetic theory really brings up in the scapegoating mechanism, is that the best way to find social cohesion, not the best way, but maybe the most efficient way to find social cohesion, is to unite against a common enemy. Mm-hmm. And this is what scapegoating is all about. It makes us feel, gives us a sense of self-righteousness, a sense of feeling good about belonging to a sense of community over and against another group.
Right. And I think just acknowledging our need to belong and how important that is, and that it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. It makes us human. It makes us capable of friendship and loving one another. But to become very conscious that that belonging is such a deep need that we can easily fall into what we call a cheap sense of belonging. And we get it in it like a quick rush,
right?
Because we're participating in some either virtual mob or unfortunately real life mobs. That can happen. We gave our Raven Award this year to Christian Picciolini, whose memoir is about that young people falling into gangs, and the reason they do it is not because they believe in white supremacy or, you know, there's nothing ideological about what's happening. It's just this need to belong. It's so strong in humans that it's our greatest strength and our downfall at the same time, you know?
Yeah, and when you identify yourself as belonging to one group, it's just easy to say, oh, well, we're not that group. So you define yourself over and against another group, and that's the danger of it. So
yeah. And you know, which is this other thing that's brought up in Violence and the Sacred really strongly, is that when you belong to a group, you also have an obligation to that group to defend it and protect it. And this is where acts of vengeance and revenge come in. Because as a group member, you're obligated to defend your group. And Renee often commented that the risk of revenge in societies where we do have a strong judicial system is so diminished and absent that we forget how dangerous it was and how fearful it was that cycles of vengeance would spin out of control.
Well, that's what this article really brings out that you found online. It's called Facebook Rumors Fuel Thirst for Revenge. And people can Google it. We'll link to it. But it talks about how Facebook is going into countries that don't have a strong judicial system, don't have a strong police system. And when it goes into those places, that's where people take something, it says vigilante justice, right? Yeah. People take justice into their own hands. And that's where you get these cycles of revenge going back and forth because there's not a strong institutional system. And I want to be very careful talking about institutional systems because we know very well that the police system in the United States is not perfect. Some would say it's not great. And we also know that the judicial system is not perfect. It's not great. But it is better than the alternative. I want to be careful about saying it's better than the alternative, because it's better than the alternative. I'll be very honest about this. For me as a white male, it's better. If I were a black person, I probably wouldn't be talking about it like this as positively. But that means that we have a lot of work to do to make the judicial system and our police system better.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, it's very, these are very difficult things to talk about because, you know, on one hand, we're talking theoretically about social structures and so forth, but they have real life applications for people. But when we're talking about a culture without a judicial system versus one that has one, what's the big difference there? The difference is that in pre-judicial societies, they still operated on the principle of sacrificial substitution. So when vengeance was sought, when a crime was committed and revenge was sought, it couldn't fall on the actual perpetrator. It would fall on a substitute victim, so that you wouldn't, a substitute victim chosen so that they didn't trigger retaliation, right? So we look on these pre-judicial societies, these sacrificial societies, and we think they were a little crazy because they were not going after the real perpetrator, but some substitute. And you see that in vigilante violence, that in Sri Lanka, they weren't actually going after the person who actually supposedly beat up the truck driver. They were just going after a member of the group, the same religious group, and punishing the group. But that's very dangerous because then that other group retaliates, and then you get this cycle that can spin out of control. So what the judicial system does is says, wait a minute, we're going to go at, we're going to find the real perpetrator. And that's who we're going to punish. And so in that sense, it's a bit of a moral advance, you might say, because instead of just going after a substitute victim and, you know, sweeping up people who had nothing to do with the incident, we're going to try and find the person that was actually guilty and punish them with so much authority and finality that no retaliation will be possible. Now, as you point out, the problem is we don't always find the correct guilty person, and there are still sacrificial categories of people who can get caught up and blamed and be declared guilty, and everyone believes it, even though they're not guilty. And so that's where the work has to be done in making the system we have more honest and true, that it really is, that judgment is really falling on a guilty person, and that the punishment is in proportion to the crime. We still have a long way to go in all those areas.
No, we have a long way to go. And, you know, we're to be Black in America is to be born guilty.
I mean, yeah.
that's what we know. And we have to change that cultural narrative. But that's also how we're discovering we need more justice, a better sense of justice.
Right.
States. So that is all from the first point of how to see if you're being, if you're caught up in scapegoating. Hate feels good.
Yeah.
Being against another group feels good. So that's one sign that we're caught up in scapegoating. The second point that's related to it is you are right and you know who is wrong, and it's always the other people. It's not right. You who are wrong. Jonathan Haidt, I know that you read his book, The Righteous Mind, talks about a lot.
Yes.
And
it's so interesting how we want to be right more than we want to be good, really.
Yeah. That's interesting. We want to be right more than we want to be good. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I think whenever you read something or fall into a group where you just feel like, ah, I knew that was true. I knew I was right.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be humble enough to ask ourselves at that point, you know, are we scapegoating? Meaning, are we shutting out some voice that we need to be listening to, some perspective that we've ignored that might make us feel uncomfortable because we won't be right anymore?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, no one wants to be wrong.
Right.
But the only way to avoid scapegoating is to admit that we're all wrong a little bit, a lot of the time, you know, and it's okay. That's it, being human too.
I remember we interviewed our friend James Allison once, who wrote the book, The Joy of Being Wrong. And I was... Yeah. The first question that I asked him about that book was the title. And I said something like, how can you say there's any kind of joy in being wrong? Like, I want to be right all the time, which means other people are wrong. There's no joy in being wrong. And he said something like, well, the joy of being wrong is that you can give up. You don't have to fight so much anymore. Like, your identity doesn't have to be caught up in being right. You don't have to fight for this as much anymore. And there's a certain amount of joy in being able to let go of that.
He's so right. You just begin to relax. So I think that's a good sign, Adam. So when you feel like you're right, and when you're feeling like you have to defend that position so much, so strongly, that's a good time to ask yourself some questions about whether you're scapegoating. Yeah. And to find that place where you can relax a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
So the third point, you already hit on it a little bit, is that you know you're caught up in scapegoating when there are people who don't deserve to be listened to or to be respected.
Yeah.
Yes. So let's just listen to the other. right? But this gets to the whole Facebook conversation, right? Because we are in our culture, we're in this debate over the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment, which is about guns, the First Amendment, which is about freedom of speech. So we're in this debate about these two amendments. So let's talk of the First Amendment. Freedom of speech is kind of under fire. Like there are people, like, we want to emphasize the need to listen to one another.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also, like, there's hate speech. There's, like, this is the whole problem that Facebook is coming up against. Mm-hmm. Is there certain language that's being used on Facebook that Facebook needs to say, no, we're taking that down because that is offensive? Nobody should be listening to this kind of language.
Right. I mean, that's certainly the kind of community I would like to belong to. You know, I just think about in my family, with my grandkids, if they start saying things that are inappropriate, I say, we don't say that here. That's not how we talk to one another. No. We say that in our churches, in our businesses, there's ground rules,
mm-hmm.
For how we engage with one another. And I think that Facebook, you know, has to recognize that they're not a technology company, and they're not a platform. They're a community. They're a way to form community, and communities have standards. Mm-hmm. You have to. Yes, we have freedom to speak, but freedom involves responsibility to one another.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're truly free, you're truly taking responsibility for yourself. No one else's, you are. And we need to hold one another up to those standards. I believe that. I mean, maybe, I don't know, I'm not as libertarian as Peter Thiel is, but I just don't want to be part of a community that doesn't have basic standards of respect for one another's perspective.
Well, and this is the danger that mimetic theory helps us understand, is that reality, whether it's true or fake reality or whatever you want to call it, fake news or whatever, is mediated to us from others.
Right.
Right. And so when we're constantly bombarded with negativity that's on Facebook or wherever we find it, Twitter or the news, whatever, that's going to start to form us, because those are our models. And so that's where we keep coming back to this, that we as individuals need to take responsibility for what comes, what we see and what starts to form us. So I love what Melvin Bray says, is that our responsibility is to tell a better story.
Yeah.
And so I'm still struggling with whether or not that can happen on Facebook, which just feeds and promotes negativity. It feels like we're already up on an uphill battle. A better story, when better stories of reconciliation and hope and love and compassion don't get spread as much. We're already in an uphill battle. So,
yeah, I suppose, but we have the power of the little thingy, the little stoppy thingy.
Uh-huh.
And we also have the power to shape the community that we participate in on Facebook. Yep. It's all within our power. And, you know, listening to diverse voices and also not falling under the illusion that Facebook is the real world. Mm-hmm. I mean, we need to do some reality checks there. I know that we talk to people we know on Facebook, but we're not actually with them.
Mm-hmm.
We're not physically with them. We're doing that. We're in some sort of virtual space, and it's not real. Okay. Just going to go out there and go out on the limb and say, when you're on Facebook, you're not in the real world.
Yeah.
And let's be real clear about that. And so it's much more important to talk to the people in the room with you, down the street from you and so forth, than it is to be, you know, in this virtual space.
It is really weird. Like, because in the real world, I have friends who act very differently in the real world than they do on Facebook. It's like you almost have like this other persona when you're on social media that allows you to behave in different ways. And I might do that too. I don't know. But it's just really interesting. Like I'll see stuff and I'm like, who are you?
Isn't that funny?
Maybe the Russian bots. I don't know. Just be my friends. I don't know.
Well, you know, and when you get to this fake news conversation, I always want to ask people, like, look at your news feed. Is that true or is it fake news?
Right.
You know, because I think we're always posturing.
Yep.
When we're online, we're either our worst selves or trying to present our best selves, you know. And if you look at my feed, I'm a very private person, so I don't put much out there, but most people are putting the highlights, the highlight reel, you know, on their newsfeed, which is not true.
Right.
It's a glimpse of some things that happen, but it's not the whole truth.
Right. Yep.
And so I think we all participate in this fake reality, fake news kind of stuff without taking responsibility for it.
Yeah. Just what we do. So
that's what we
do. Yeah. A little bit of real world reminder of what the real world is a good thing, especially when we're on social media. So
I think so.
We've talked about, here we've got a comment from Maura. It may be similar to how people behave while driving in heavy is usually quite different from how they act when standing.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's a good point. Although when I'm in a long line, I can get pretty hostile when I'm in a long line.
I can get testy too. That's when you bring out your phone and go on Facebook.
There you go. Yes.
To distract you. It has its purposes.
Yeah, that's good. So we've talked about the judicial system. Hey, how about that? We've talked about how Facebook can often breed a sense of revenge online and signs that you are scapegoating. Nicely done. Yeah. Awesome.
Oh, I know.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you everybody for watching and for listening in. And hey, if you have comments or questions, feel free to leave them either on the Facebook page, the Raven Review, or on iTunes or anywhere where you can find podcasts. So yeah, check us up on Podbean and other places. So thank you everyone for watching and listening in, and join me and Lindsay Paris Lopez this coming Monday at 10 o'clock Central AM. That's 8 o'clock AM. I'll just be waking up, get a good cup of coffee. And we're going to be talking about Tony Bartlett's book, Seven Stories. We'll be discussing the fifth chapter in that book. So hope you can join us then. Until then, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.